With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys.
Podcast Like It. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 getting blown off the runway here in 2021. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I am Phil Isco.
And with us today is the color man from the Screen Drafts podcast, Phil and I have both been on not nearly enough times. Ryan, he's also the general manager of the Arrow Theater in Santa Monica, the finest repertory theater in LA.
Is it's one of them, you know, it's one of them. I would say it's,
well, it's the finest,
but you know,
the
it's finest. Up for debate. It's
yes.
I also, it should be said too, that you are recording yes. From the Arrow. So behind Ryan, which when we recorded the Winona Ryder one, if I'm not mistaken, you might've been there too. But the reason I say this is just, it is glorious to see a person in a movie theater
pretty,
right
young.
Now. We should all be very excited about that.
Yes. I'll be sure to FaceTime you from Cruella this weekend.
Please do.
Yeah, no, I'm very excited actually to be on this podcast from the Arrow. I feel like it's the two things I've been thinking about a lot in the last week have been these two things and really nothing else. The Arrow is primed to be open. We have upgraded literally everything. We've painted this place. We've cleaned this place. It's gorgeous. It's honestly, I think, the best it's looked in maybe 25, 30 years. And it's been fascinating to That's just awesome. Be a part of it, you know, to just see the transformation over the last, like, honestly, this year was a big one and we did a big renovation 3 years ago. So the Arrow is sort of, you know, and it's 80 years old this year. So it's kind of fascinating Incredible. To kind of see it get such a wonderful, you know, upgrade all throughout this year. So the American Cinematheque is ready to fly its flag here at the Arrow.
Where can people find
it? It's all online. We have a brand new website. We've rebranded. It looks gorgeous. There's so many cool things that are happening on this website, including, like, you know, honestly, virtual events that happen every week and have throughout the course of the pandemic.
Sure.
But yeah, it's...
There's some great shit coming up. Wow.
You know what? Fuck it. I'm going to look at it right now. Hold on a second.
For listeners of the pod, Indiana Jones' Last Crusade will be there on June 20th, which is a film we did on our 89 pod. I personally might go there for In and of Itself, which I've yet to watch and wanted to watch. Now I think it might be a great experience to watch on the big screen.
E.T. in 70 millimeter.
For children.
E.T.
For people with children, yes.
We're opening with a full month of 70 millimeter. I mean, to be clear, that's exactly what we wanted to do, because it's kind of like, look, we're all back. Let's get the screen as big as possible. Yeah. Let's get our sound, which we've upgraded here. Oh. Like, I mean, there's a rumble in the seats now at the Arrow. Like, it's a really weird, different experience than it was before. So that's just really exciting.
I'm going to go. I'm calling my shot right now. I've been wanting to see Lawrence of Arabia in a movie theater my entire life. I bought tickets because they did it recently. You know that there's something that does it, whatever. I bought tickets 6 months in advance, and it turned out I was out of town that day and couldn't go. So yes. There's two nights, Lawrence of Arabia, the 26th and 27th. I will be in town. I'm going to one of those nights. I'm doing it right now, putting it on the family calendar. And
family calendar. I want to see Vertigo.
70 millimeter. It is a glorious. Yep.
Kenny shrugging off Vertigo.
Overrated. I mean, the best film of all time. Wow. Come on. It is.
Blasphemy.
It is. It's not the best film of all time.
I didn't say it was the best film of all time. It's a great movie, though.
Sight and sound did. Have you seen Field of Dreams, Ryan? I mean, come on.
Here we go.
I'm kidding.
I know.
Jeez Louise, I'm not trying to lose our guest from the cheap seats at the Arrow trying to argue Field of Dreams is better than Vertigo. All right, Ryan, the movie we're doing tonight is Pushing Tin. Do you know why you are here for Pushing Tin?
I do. I think that I don't really, but I have I feel like it's kind of slipped out somewhere throughout Screen Drafts that I do kind of like personally, sort of low key love this movie. But I don't know where, and I don't know who gave that away. Maybe. Okay.
Kenny will tell you, I'm sure.
So I wish I did my own research, but I didn't. So basically, I think right after our pod, whenever that was, whenever we recorded the Bruckheimer pod, which is, you know, one of the best drafts I did, we said to Ryan, we'd love to have you on the podcast, so please come on. But I'm like, I mean, if we find something for him, whatever. And then I was listening to a screen draft like the next day, and you mentioned on that screen, Jeff, and I don't know which one it was, but you mentioned, yeah, as you said, you kind of low-key loved that movie. So immediately I was like, we got
to be right away.
I was like, we got a worm on the hook Pushing Tin. we got to reel this baby.
He texted me right away. He's like, Ryan Marker, big Pushing Tin fan. And I was like, all right, lock it in.
So that is why we asked you if you wanted to do it, and immediately I think you were like yes. But the thing about Pushing Tin is, I do think it has its fans. I think that it actually wouldn't have been. I'm joking.
Three stars.
Yeah, I'm joking. I'm joking. maybe a third of what I just said is a joke. Most of it's true, but the part that's a joke is we could have. There are people who wanted to do this movie. We went with the best person.
I see.
So you, of course, and we're so happy to have you, Ryan. I gotta say, if somehow our listeners have not listened to Screen Drafts, the podcast really wouldn't work without Ryan. It really doesn't make sense without you there, because you want to know well, I'll tell you the thing you do that I do that, you know, great podcasters do. We don't like you don't like every movie, and you did it on our podcast when you just took me to task for my Top Gun pick, and I curled up into a ball and cried. But it's appropriate, because when you later when you later talk about your love for particular films, I know it's coming from a genuine place, and you're also not a snob, like so many people, so many Cogmans are. So, you know, it's
wow. Seriously, firing across the bow.
So, love it.
So I'm trying to take his place. I'm trying to Ripley him out of this podcast. Next time you book Cogman, I'm going to show up.
I think
I'm
this
shave
is a
my head and show
this
up.
This is a WrestleMania match. I think Nibart versus Cogman. I mean, let's be honest.
I know. I feel like I'm like punching up over here. The point is I really enjoy your takes on the podcast, and I feel like you're the one who really solidifies whether or not it was a good pick or a bad pick. And I think that's really important.
That's fascinating.
I think to double down on what Kenny's saying, I think that, you know, podcasts that have two hosts, you know, it's a balance, right? And I think that obviously both sides bring something valuable to the equation, but like you and Clay are very different in your tastes in the best possible ways. And I think that that helps, you know, make the podcast feel lived in. It doesn't feel like, you know, I think that Kenny and I have a similar dynamic, although I do think we agree a lot of the time. And I think you and Clay agree a fair amount of the time.
It's just an interesting thing. I mean, you're totally right. What I think of the most with Clay, who's honestly one of the greatest guys and one of my best friends, I'd say at this point, he had to literally drag me to do a podcast. I said, no, I don't want to do that. I really turned him down. Like when he was like, let's do this thing, Screen Drafts, right, after Vidiot sort of had to, you know, sort of wind down. I was just like, I don't know, dude. That seems really long, you know. So it's fascinating after all this time that I do think we've sort of both accepted, you know, our fates, and that Screen Jeffs is just a super fun show to bear witness to. And I'm honored that you would say that about my contributions to the show. That's fascinating to hear, honestly, because it is Clay's baby. He invented the game.
Here's what I do know, though.
I was going to say, I think I've said this to Clay, or I don't know, I've certainly said it somewhere in my life. There's real genius in Screen Drafts, because Screen Drafts as a game is dumb, but Screen Drafts as a podcast is excellent. It's a gentleman's game, right? So it relies on the two people agreeing to not talk before and agreeing to keep their cards close to the vest. So it's not really a game in any real sense. It's you have to kind of work to make it a game. But as a podcast, the countdown format is so tense. Like it really does matter to me.
Right.
Like what gets near the top. And that's the genius.
It needs to be said that I remember when I texted Kenny and said, I'm going on Screen Drafts with Dana. We're going to do a Winona Ryder draft. And Kenny texted me and said, I got to be honest, I don't really get the rules. And Kenny's a rules guy.
Because it's a bad game.
That wasn't a judgment, right? It's a great podcast. But I tried to explain the rules. And in explaining the rules, even I kind of was like, I'm not really sure I understand the rules. And then you listen to it and you're just like, oh, yeah, no,
right.
This is great.
And it's awesome. Very elaborate rules that really only lie in Clay's brain. Like, I know the rules by now, but it took me a long time, you know, and we added rules as we go. I mean, it's sort of.
It makes total sense to me now, but as I was explaining it before I went on with Dana, I was just sort of like, I think I kind of get it. And then Kenny was like, listen, I'm sure it'll be a great episode. And then you listen to it, obviously, and he's like, okay, now I get what the brilliance of
best,
this
perfect
podcast.
Episode. There's a great quote about Wikipedia, which is, it would never work in theory only. It could never work in theory only in practice. Which is to say, if I told you we were going to have an open source encyclopedia that anybody can access at any moment, you'd think it was bedlam, like GeoCities was bedlam or any other crazy open source thing. But Wikipedia is more accurate than the actual encyclopedia because it only works in practice. I love Wikipedia. I feel the same way about Screen Drafts, which is, in theory, it doesn't work.
You have to actually listen and experience it. And then it is the most rewarding podcast.
It also needs to be something you care about too, right? Like you need to listen to, at least in the beginning, you need to listen to a draft that you're invested in. Like I think about Kenny's text to me during the Pixar draft. And Kenny was just like during a lot. Like at a certain point, Kenny just texted me like, this is just someone just scorched earth for no reason. And it...
You should have stopped the draft right there. I mean, I know it's unethical, but you just should have said this didn't exist. Lost episode.
But I know, Ryan,
we went out of our way to get Griffin Newman on this app, but goodbye.
So Ryan,
yes,
Pushington. Did you see Pushington in 99 or around 99, or is this a film that you've recently?
No, I saw it when it came out. I saw it on video when it came out. I was in college. I worked at a video store. I managed a video store. It was my college job. And, you know, like it was just one of those movies that I would say, like, and I still stand by this, Pushington is a wacky movie. Like it's definitely like a wild ride. Like there's something chaotic and shambolic about it that I just love. But I would say that definitely it really only works in two places, and that's like after midnight or on a plane. Those are
really, you'd want to watch this on a plane?
Absolutely.
That's the last place I'd want to watch.
I love a plane movie on a plane.
It's
really like,
with you.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not afraid of crashing. That's the thing.
See, I'm terrified of flying, so I don't want to double down and start
then this,
watching.
Then for you, Phil, it's after midnight. No. Don't watch it at 7:30. This is not a movie to, you know.
Well, then maybe I watched it at the wrong time. Maybe Kenny and I watched it at the wrong time.
in three chunks at 7:30 a.m., then at a coffee shop for an hour, and my car on my phone. Is that the wrong way to watch it, Ryan?
Pushington got the creme de la creme viewing experience from Kenny Neibart.
Pushy. Well, I was too busy listening to the Screen Draft podcast. I had to fit in wherever I could.
So I'm going to give a synopsis and just get this out of the way right up top, because I don't think a lot of people know what Pushington is.
Interesting.
Is the thing as well. Like, so just let me get this out of the way real quick. A new recruit unsettles the close-knit team of air traffic controllers who look after flights in and out of New York, filmed in Toronto. His serious and competitive approach, coupled with a wild side for his character, give a highly dangerous edge to his relationship with the team's reigning star performer, one that spills over into our personal lives. Sorry. Written by Glenn and Les Charles of Cheers fame, their only screenwriting credit, feature screenwriting credit. Directed by Mike Newell of Four Weddings and a Funeral, Donnie Brasco, or Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire fame. Pushington opened on April 23rd, 1999 in fourth place behind The Matrix, Life, and Never Been Kissed. It would go on to make $8.4 million on a $33 million budget. It's got 48% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 42% from audiences. Roger Ebert gave the film 3 stars and said, like an overloaded airplane struggling to lift off, the characters in Pushington leap free of the runway only to be pulled back down by the plot. John Cusack and Billy Bob Thornton play two air traffic controllers who are prickly and complex, who take hold of a scene and shake it awake and make it alive, only to be brought down by simpering series of happy endings. For at least an hour, there is hope that the movie will amount to something singular. It takes us into a world we haven't seen much of, air traffic control center. Controllers peer into their computer screens like kids playing a video game, barking instructions with such alarming quickness that we wonder how pilots can understand them. They use cynicism to protect themselves from the terrors of the job. One guy, an aluminum shower in his future. The movie opens with a laconic observation. You land a million planes safely. Then you have one little midair and you never hear the end of it. The movie is not going to be shown on airplanes. Ironically, it is. The movie also does an observant job of showing us the atmosphere inside an air traffic control center, where the job description includes depression, nervous breakdowns, heart attacks, and hypertension. The movie is worth seeing for the good stuff. I'm recommending it because the performances and the details in the air traffic control center. The director is Mike Newell. His gift in making his characters come alive is so real that it actually underlines the weakness of the ending. We believe we know Russell and Nick, know them so well, we can tell in the last half hour when they stop being themselves and start being puppets of a boring studio ending.
Yeah, it does not sound like a 3 out of 4.
A star review?
Recommend, A recommendation. Yeah. That's. But I
there's stuff that I agree with and stuff I don't. But I mean, by and large, I don't think that Ebert's being completely unfair.
I hear that. I would say, however, this movie, you know, has a kind of, I don't think it's kind of aiming for, you know, sort of a realism. I think that's sort of, it's always been confusing to me when people see this movie and don't like it for that reason. It's certainly kind of a romantic comedy set in this world. And it's not even,
romantic?
Well, it's
I was gonna say, comedic. Where's the romance?
I hear what you're saying, and you know, I wouldn't say it's a romantic comedy. However, I do think it kind of has traces of sort of that sort of late '90s who gives a fuck quality to, you know, sexual politics, you know, and I.
More than traces. Yeah, that's its downfall for me.
And I will say that there is a large degree of nostalgia for me for this movie. I think that the performances sort of transcend sort of the shakiness of the script. However, I do think that there's a lot of like interesting, I'm always a sucker, like, and I will admit this, I am a sucker for like a meta quality to a late 90s movie. And to me, like, this is a vintage 1999 movie. It's not a movie that was made like that much thereafter, obviously. It has a very clear pre 9/11 feel, you know.
It's very true.
It's got like janky special effects running throughout it. It's like,
oh, when they get blown by the jet wash at the end, it's
incredible. I mean, I just love this era of special effects where they just. They thought they were working at all cylinders, and like, you know, within 5 years, you're like, holy shit, this is insane.
I also love that this is pre Tom Cruise just humiliating every leading man and forcing them to do their own insane stunts, or else they're like big wimps. So 5 years, 10 years later, when Tom Cruise is literally hanging off the side of a plane taking off, they absolutely really would have done this. I guarantee you, they really would have done this. They would have been lining up to really do this.
So I want to piggyback on what you were saying a little bit, Ryan, which is that, first of all, I want to be above board. I didn't hate this movie. I have big problems with this movie. I think there is a great movie in there. I think that the major problem I had with it is that I'm not convinced that Mike Newell really understands the tone of this movie, because the score is truly insane at times, where like it's doing crazy heavy lifting in all the wrong emotions, where you're just like, wait a second, do you understand what the, like, so and this is maybe unfair. I'm going to jump to the very end for a second here, because it crystallizes for me everything that's great and bad about this movie, which is, I just want to talk about the scene with Cate Blanchett at the end, which is that her and her estranged husband are sort of separated, and he uses his air traffic controller, what have you, to have the pilot call her into the cockpit so he can have a conversation with her and explain to her how much he loves her.
Yeah.
The idea there, I love that idea. I actually think that's a really great thing. The execution of it is totally fucking awful, which is that like this earnest music comes in and like the joke is lost. Like it should be a jokey, funny moment. And instead it's so earnest and odd that you're like, I don't know how I'm supposed to feel about this right now.
Or he should have been better.
Or
because
the singing,
the emotion behind it. One of my favorite scenes in movies is when Jerry O'Connell sings to Neve Campbell in Scream 2. Because he puts him like, you are so programmed in the beginning of the movie to hate that character. Right. And to look at him sideways because he might be the killer. And after that moment, you are desperate that he is not the killer, right? You are, because he is so winning in that moment. Jerry O'Connell can't fucking sing either, but he gives him entire self over to it.
Yes.
John
Cusack doesn't give himself over in this moment because he doesn't he doesn't believe it. He doesn't believe the moment.
Well, it's a tough situation. Yeah,
again, I do believe that there's a large degree of like magical realism going on in this movie. And granted, like it's a bizarre tone. I mean, I will totally grant, you know, John Cusack's character throughout this is like repulsive. You know, he's really kind of not a very good dude at all. It's a movie. Yeah. I gotta say again, it's sort of like a subversive pleasure for me because I recognize these things. I understand it's not, you know, I mean, this is.
I don't think you do. I think you're. No, I'm kidding.
The thing is, it's the little pleasures of this movie. It's like John Cusack, this is his high point. Like, this is, you know, I mean, he had a fucking magical 1999. Like, this, Cradle Will Rock, and being John Malkovich all in 1 year. Like, that's insane.
Insane.
On the heels of High Fidelity and Gross Point Blank. So like he is kind of in the sweet spot of, and this movie, again, I sort of enjoy him in the way that we just did an episode on James Spader, in the same way that I sort of love hate John Cusack. I love hate James Spader characters, you know, James like Spader, he allows you to be like, he allows himself to be shitty and not really.
But don't you think that like that unlikability, Kenny and I talked a little bit about this today. For the first time, Kenny and I got brunch in 16 or 15 months.
We had our first hug in a long time.
It was great. And we were talking a little bit about, and I brought up the idea that John Cusack, often his characters have jealousy at the center of them. And he can make that palatable under the right circumstances, right? Like I think about High Fidelity being a very good example of that. He's a fucking prick in that movie. And yet somehow you find your ways to kind of love him. This movie, he doesn't do that though. Like this movie, unfortunately, it tips in a bunch of ways. I think about that scene with him and Angelina Jolie in her car where he's yelling at her.
Oh, it's fucking, it's unbelievable.
Infidelity to her husband. And you're just like, you're a terrible human. I don't give a shit about anything you do now.
I want to take my wax at this movie. batter up. So So Ryan, your point that there's a fair amount of magical realism running through this movie, I agree with. My complaint is that it's not there. Mm-hmm. There is not nearly enough of that. And the script, I think, allows for an execution that would have leaned into that. And there are a bunch of different ways it could have happened. But I think that Mike Newell botched it. And I think that the sexual politics of 1999 made for an environment where cheating on your spouse is not the kind of sin that destroys a character. Like it is the kind of sin that destroyed a character from the dawn of the dawn of time until 1997, and then again in like 2005. So like for this one weird period where every like right-minded liberal decided it's okay to cheat because our president cheated, it's cool, then all these movies decided that wasn't the end of this character. Okay, so as I said this to Phil, and I think it's my best point about this film. this script, you take this exact same script, and it would have been a killer movie in 1979. They would have made a paranoid thriller and it would have been incredible. Right. And it's there. Like, it's there. His character is one step away from losing his mind and thinking that he literally thinks Billy Bob Thornton is trying to bring down his plane or put him into a storm or whatever. Like, it could have been a conspiracy theorist type movie like that with almost the same exact script.
Jason Robards is in it, you know.
Sure.
Bruce Stern.
Yeah, of course. Yes. It's a Parallax View. It's
This is totally a Sidney Pollack movie.
And then it could have been.
It could have been.
And then in 89, this would have been a James L. Brooks movie.
Maybe.
Yeah.
And they would have actually known how to play out this sexual dynamic between these four people in a way that we would have understood. And it would have been less about what I consider to be, as I said to Phil, an absurd premise for a rivalry. Because there are no mid-air collisions. It's not a thing that happens. So all these guys, everybody who works at the air traffic control office, are the best. They are all zone, 100% baby. The best guys. There's no such thing as better. They're all the zone. They're all the zone. There's no one. You can't walk in there and say, I'm the best air traffic controller. No, nobody in here has crashed the plane. You're all the best. So there's no, like, all Billy Bob Thornton has is he dresses better. That's it. So they would have dropped that absurd element, and they would have made it more personal, and it would have been able to actually play out these things. Then in 2009, I think there could have been a movie here. And I think you could have had a one-act
post
9/11, post 9/11, more or less one set indie film that takes place. It could have been a play about air traffic controllers, about sexual rivalries within there, about having, you know, something that bothers me about this movie is it does something that I think is very unrealistic. It takes a profession where no one ever fucks up. And I even went through it with Phil today. Like, when was the last mid-air collision in America? It was 27 years ago. So no one ever fucks up.
It's been a while.
Doesn't happen. No one ever fucks up. Right?
Okay. Magical realism, Kenny.
Which is fine. And it presupposes that there's a possibility that these people might fuck up. Right? So if you want to set that as your premise, you can go through the magical realism thing.
Yeah.
Or you could have them continue to kick ass while all this shit is happening around them and show how they have to somehow be unflappable here while this guy is cheating on your, you know, cheating, you're sleeping with your wife and that guy's going after your job or whatever it is. But I think it got lost. I think this movie is lost. I think it is all the things I mentioned halfway. And my takeaway is, it's how much do you hold a film back? How much do you downgrade a film for being fine, but not being what it could be?
I want to agree and disagree for a second here. And I want to kind
All right.
No, I know, but I don't, I'm serious though. Like, I think that I agree with a lot of things you're saying, and there's something I don't agree with. I saw the film in 99 in the theater. I remember I was actually texting with my buddy today. We went to see it together. And I remember, sitting in the theater, you know, again, I'm 19 years old. I just started film school, and I'm excited by this cast, and I'm excited by the notion of this movie. And I remember it was kind of weird, you know, it got released in a weird time, and it didn't obviously get a lot of love, and it kind of just, you know, it was what it was. And I remember I left the theater with my buddy, Simon Ennis, past and future guest, and he fucking hated it. Like, he was angry. He was just like, I'm bummed that I fucking gave 2 hours of my life to this movie. And I left it feeling like, you know, Angelina Jolie and Cate Blanchett were both sort of, you know, at the beginning of their crest of fame, obviously. And I was fascinated by them. Billy Bob, I liked Sling Blade, like, and John Cusack, obviously. So, like, I was excited by this cast. And I left the film feeling disappointed, could have been better. Watched it the other day. First of all, I also just want to say, and Kenny can attest to this, I've been excited to talk about this movie for a while. It's a movie that I've kind of kept in the back burner because I think it's weird. I don't think it's great, but I think it's a really interesting, emblematic 99 movie of four huge stars for all intents and purposes in a very strange movie directed by the guy who shouldn't have done it, written by, you know, multi-cam writers. Like, it's just odd. There's a lot of oddness going on here. And finishing it today, I kind of had similar feelings to when I left the theater in 99, which is a wasted opportunity that had a lot of interesting stuff in it that is just not, doesn't all come together. But there are scenes, there are ideas, there's stuff in this that I'm just like, this is great.
Can you believe this is Mike Newell's follow-up to Donnie Brasco?
It's fucking crazy.
It's
surreal.
And you can see that in the, like, do you remember, like, the barbecue? Where I was like, this feels like this is like a cut scene from Donnie Brasco.
They crossboarded the two movies, I think, and they just doubled up just on
like,
the set.
Did he just like all of a sudden decide, oh yeah, I get this scene. Yeah. It's Donnie Brasco. I know. No, it's not.
But the scene where they're all the wives are kind of like shitting on their husbands.
Yeah.
He got a little confused, I think. He got a little confused.
Yeah, I think. Yeah. But then saying is right. There's also a part of me, though, that feels like this is the end of an era in the sense where big stars could make big swings with kind of complex characters out of not a great script. I think that you're absolutely right about the structure of this film and the problems of sort of just the general narrative and tone of the movie. But it's weird, mm-hmm. You know, I love a late 90s movie where, Billy Bob and Angelina in this film, I mean, this is where they met. This is where they got in Toronto.
That's where they found love.
And they're both...
they found love in a hopeless place.
In a hopeless place. Fuck you.
But I love both of these actors. I've always loved these actors. I mean, they're incredible.
The
and there is a weird energy that is like runs all throughout this movie. And I think, you know, it's sort of... it sort of dovetails nicely with the energy of the movie, I think.
It's like I think about the scene of him singing at that Italian restaurant and she's on her knees, just clutching his legs. And then there's another scene where he's singing and she's grinding against him. And I'm just like, what movie are these two people in?
I don't know, but it's fascinating that they're having such an effect on John Cusack and his life.
Yes, sure.
All right, so let's get into that a little bit. Because,
I mean, for a guy who loves have to say, this movie has Top Gun vibes all throughout.
One of my great regrets of my life is playing Top Gun. Because I don't even like that much. And it would have been so much cooler if I played American Gigolo. And it also would have given Ryan a correct point on his, you know, commissioner game.
Yep.
But it's so upsetting to me. But okay.
Okay.
I think this movie is best viewed through the meta lens you just described. Because why are the only reason these two people would have such an effect on John Cusack is because for the same reason they had such an effect on America.
Mm-hmm.
Because what the fuck? Because they're a giant what the fuck. Now, I also think I loved them together. Mm-hmm. Angelina Jolie is probably my favorite actress. I think she's the best actress. I think she's the best at being an actress, and I think she's probably my favorite actress. And I also that also kind of put her into this mind space where she goes for a very specific kind of guy. You know, she goes like Billy Bob is it? Billy Bob is an A+. Don't get me wrong, but Billy Bob's not Brad Pitt, and her dating Brad Pitt was almost like. Right. A letdown to me.
What he said when he was on mm-hmm. he was on a radio show. Someone asked him about her dating Brad Pitt, and he's like, "Yeah, she's going through her quarterback phase, or like her high school quarterback phase." Like it felt like he was basically just being like, "Yeah, she's decided to shack up with the popular guy," which I mean,
but
I
you know,
he was sort of right. I don't know, but
well, he's a babe. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, no,
but Billy Bob, you know, is a very fascinating dude. I mean, I really think that he is. I feel like this character that he plays in this, I think that he took this role solely because he saw very clearly himself in this role. There's this weird, he's like he's like a great singer and he's a great fisherman and he's a great air traffic controller.
But he's also a weird guru of self-help.
But he's also a fucking asshole. Like he's sort of a dick. Like have you ever seen that great interview where he told the producer not to talk to him about his acting life. He's only there for his band. And he like literally puts this interviewer through 10 minutes of like nightmarish hell, you know? And it's such a dickish interview. Like I've never seen anything so difficult and cringeworthy as that interview. And I think this movie, he's that guy. And he's sort of like, that's what gets under John Cusack's skin. And then that all turns against him in a weird like sexual nightmare where he, you know, he has sex with Angelina Jolie. Like it's insane. Like what this dude is going through, but it's odd.
It's, it, it's, It's so bizarre. Strange. And like bonus points for being really bizarre, but like negative points for not doing anything interesting with it.
Kenny, so, it ends with like, a bomb threat. Yeah. Like, it's how much more interesting could it be?
Don't even. I mean, we'll get to the bomb threat. But
I want to talk about your boy Billy Bob.
He's amazing.
With Angelina or just Billy Bob in general?
I want to talk about Billy Bob in general, and Angelina, you know, undoubtedly will come up. But the thing about
Billy Bob, didn't they wear vials of each other's blood? And not like weird, had, not and they weird. Had Velcro harnesses so they could have sex and, you know, on the ceiling.
He's as tall as anyway, I have met him a couple times. He came into the video store I worked at, and he's literally as tall. I mean, I'm 5'2". I'm a really short dude. He's, you know, a little guy, and he has a presence like he's like kind of fucking tough and a big guy. I don't know. There is, you know, it's a very interesting kind of juxtaposition with him.
I think you're getting at something that I'm like kind of trying to dance around right now, which is the male virility of Billy Bob Thornton. He is, you know, I think he is a day player essentially before Sling Blade. Like, he works and he's been in stuff, but he's essentially, you know, he's an actor's actor on his own. And I know he made a short before some folks called a Sling Blade, which I rented by accident once, so I saw that before I saw the actual movie Sling Blade.
Yeah,
it's the first act of the movie in black and white with Molly Ringwald. But he plays, you know, he plays a everyone knows who he plays in Sling Blade. So that's that answer. And the next big role he has is Simple Plan, right, where he plays a very similar character. Right.
Good movie.
It's an amazing movie, amazing Minnesota set movie, one of the best Minnesota set movies of all time, according to a podcast I listened to. And he, I'm wondering if Billy Bob Thornton, and then he plays Armageddon, where he's certainly playing an alpha, and he's very fucking cool in that movie.
He's really good in that movie.
The best part of that movie. I'm wondering if Billy Bob Thornton is having a hard time playing these beta males with mental deficiencies. And hard pivot to
pushing
I want to see how cool I can be.
Yep.
And I think
Russell
that happened.
Ball.
Yeah. Russell Bell.
Bell, sorry, Bell.
Yes, Russell Bell. But I think that's kind of what happened here, that he took the first James Dean role he could find. And I think he, you know, I think he did a fine job with what I think is an absurd character. Just an absurd role that makes no sense. Again, there is no like there is no big swinging dick among air traffic controllers. There, it's binary. There are people who crash the planes and people who don't crash the planes. And if you don't, so what John Cusack seems to be obsessed with is the fact that he like has his young hot wife. I think,
and, well, a feather. It's got a feather.
He actually is. He actually is Choctaw. I did look that up because I was going to make a big fucking point about it. Big fucking 2021 smacked out on his ass. But that was my
theory that he wanted to play himself for the first time.
This I think you're both absolutely right. I think that the virility thing is true. I think the masculinity and the alpha male, all that kind of stuff is interesting and valid. I would also, it also feels like Billy Bob's legitimately bringing his own stuff to the table. Like, I mean, I can't speak to what is his and what's in script, but like, it really feels like Billy Bob.
Well, look at what this crazy motherfucker does in 2001.
Yeah.
He played, I mean, he's in The Man Who Wasn't There. Good film.
Great movie.
He also was in Monsters Ball, which is like the most toxic example of male virility, right? Which is the most like, I'm gonna show you how fucking male I am. I'm gonna rape somebody. What do you think of that? No, it'll ever call me Sling Blade again after that. So I do think he lost his way a little bit.
I would agree. And then he
I think he found who he was again in Bad Santa, and then went from there and had his nice.
Bad Santa's great. Yeah,
I think that's who he really is.
I want to just take a quick second here, I want to kind of talk about like, I'm not entirely clear how this film gets made. Like, I know that the Charles Brothers are obviously a very big deal
in television, and they wrote this script years earlier or something like that, and it was like, quote unquote, the only feature idea they had ever had or something along those lines. And this movie does feel, has TV kind of qualities to it. In a, like, I was watching it today thinking, like, this movie kind of has like a weird Northern Exposure-y kind of vibe to it. Of that sort of like small townish kind of, you know, group of interesting, colorful supporting characters. Like, when I think about that, the actual air traffic control center, Kenny and I talked about this a little bit at lunch today, but like that, there's a multi-cam show about that, right? Like, where like,
it was called Wings.
The set,
it was called
Wings. And like, there you go. There you go. Or yeah, exactly. So yeah, like, it does have
even,
that
even
vibe.
Those morons didn't crash.
They were perfect. Didn't crash perfect pilots. Yeah.
They were, yeah, there was never a crash. But I think it's interesting. We've talked, Kenny, about almost all of these movies, but this is a Fox 2000 release, which is an imprint on the Fox when Fox, 20th Century Fox existed. The 99 movies that came out under Fox 21, or Fox 2000, that is, are Ravenous, Never Been Kissed, Pushing Tin, Lake Placid, Broke Down Palace, Fight Club, Light It Up, Anywhere But Here, and N in the King.
Yikes.
So it is a real murderer's row.
Brutal.
Of movies where you're just like, who's running this? Like, what
I was
is the
literally just going to look up who's running it so we could dunk on that fool.
Here.
Because it's like, what's the connection between it? Like, what's the thread? And clearly there isn't. Some of these movies, by the way, are legitimately great. I think Ravenous is great. I really like Never Been Kissed. Kenny's, you know, we both really loved Lake Placid. That movie's kind of insane.
Yeah, that's a good flick. Good flick.
We haven't talked about Fight Club yet. You know, it's obviously an important movie.
We've seen Fight Club. You know?
We've seen it, and it's a good movie. But this movie is such an outlier in so many ways, but also just like, I gotta think that this is just like pieces came together. It feels like it was shot relatively quickly. I'm imagining like cast got this thing, up on its feet. I really don't know. Because if I read this script, I'd just be like, I don't know what this is. And if you don't very specifically direct this thing, it's going to be
I feel like it's very clearly, for me, I think it's John Cusack at this time, like I said, I think had a lot of agency. And I have a feeling that he likes these types of movies. They're always a little off kilter. I think he's very interested in taking big swings as opposed to, even if they fail, I don't think he's like maybe the most judicious script reader, but I think he likes good character, meaty things that he can kind of act quirky and weird and do his like trench coat thing, like he's gloriously 90s.
Yeah, one wears a trench coat.
Yeah, totally.
Loves a trench coat. Yeah. It's interesting. You brought up Gross Point Blank, which I thought about, which first of all, I watched relatively recently and was just completely blown away by it all over again. Like that movie's so prickly and strange and like it's really kind of pushing buttons and I could see, to your point, Ryan, him reading this through that lens and being like, oh, okay. Like this movie's weird and I'm playing this kind of like unlikable guy, but like I'm interested. I just, and Kenny, you said this at lunch today, and I think it's like, it's just, it's the Mike Newell component that's just the wrong guy.
He whiffed. I don't think this is like a necessarily flawed script. I don't think this is a failure on the page. I just don't. I think that, I think it just takes a little bit of vision to see what you have here, and you potentially, like, I don't know. I don't know how you don't connect the idea that air traffic controllers get burnt out so easily. They can only be air traffic controllers for a period of time and then they're moved on. Yeah. How having all the thing about having more people, having more lives in your hand in a shift than searches having their whole lives, how that shit gets to you, how all that shit can't get to you. It's perfect for a paranoid thriller.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a way to go with this that was undercut by the ending and certainly undercut by all the moments of groundedness where John Cusack is just losing his mind. And it's just that simple. Like he's just losing his mind and losing his family. A movie we did this year that does that kind of, except it's, a problem was Arlington Road. where Arlington Road, you know, goes in that direction. But of course, he's right, because all conspiracy theorists and movies are right and have, you know, given rise to a fucking whole generation of people who think conspiracy theories are right. But what's more interesting, and again, we don't think this is a great movie, but the Beautiful Mind route, where the guy is wrong and he actually is, you know, like the conspiracy is not a thing, is like so much more interesting to me.
There's definitely, you're absolutely right, Kenny, that there is a thriller version of this. And again, I mean, this also just feels like...
I think it's on the page, dude. Like,
I do too.
Yeah.
I mean, it does end with a bomb threat. Yeah.
The Vicki Lewis bodybuilding runner is so fucking weird that like you that has to be in a left of center movie. That couldn't possibly exist in a real mainstream movie.
Here's the thing though. Like, I think that there are two take all of these points. I definitely do. I just think that, you know, it's fascinating to me, being a huge Cheers Frasier fan, that, you know, this is their big script. It doesn't really work, but yet it attracts such talent that in a way I think it transcends and ends up, for me, working. And I do think part of it is that, like, Angelina is killing it. Cate Blanchett, they're both killing it. I totally understand. They are abused women in this movie. Like, it's really kind of, you know, bizarre and sad. And very, very, again, classic late 90s. That's just runs rampant through the studio films, especially. But they are really acting the hell out of this movie and these characters. And I think that that's kind of, I don't know, that's partly just, again, like kind of a guilty pleasure of mine. I totally see that it's a problematic kind of element of this film, but being such a big Cate Blanchett fan, and I remember that this was like the first thing I saw of her. Like, I can't think of the movie that was before this. I'm pretty sure this was the first.
Elizabeth. She was nominated the year before for Elizabeth. Okay.
That's the thing. I don't know if I cared enough to watch that. Like, I know my brain in 1999, and Elizabeth was not there. Pushington, however, being such a Cusack fan, and you know, ultimately also.
I like that Kenny said, "Yes, of course."
Of course.
Of course, Pushington was there, but not the Academy nominated.
But she kills it, though.
Movie.
Like, it's kind of a fascinating performance.
Who wants to see Elizabeth? I mean, straight up, who wants to watch Elizabeth?
I saw Elizabeth especially, in the theater. I
especially
her.
That year when you're already like chewing through all these other like homework.
But it's a great movie. I did eventually see it, and it is like an amazing film. I mean, they both are. Movie. They're great, great films.
And we will be doing our top five Cate Blanchett films at the end of this as well.
Crystal Skull.
Crystal Skull times five.
Crystal Skull.
I don't even know what you're talking. What is Crystal Skull? I don't know what that movie is, honestly.
No one's seen. I've never heard of Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull.
No one knew that Cate Blanchett was in it.
I think that I agree with everything you're saying, Ryan, in the sense that I was fascinated by both of them, Angelina Jolie and Cate Blanchett. They were probably big driving forces to getting me to the theater. I think that they are bringing their energies and their complexities and stuff to roles that I think are thinly drawn, unfortunately. But I think that they're bringing stuff to it that makes it interesting. But I would also say, too, that, you know, to come back to what you guys were saying about the script, I think that the script does feel very unfocused. There's a bunch of, like, wouldn't it be fun to do this? And it does feel like guys that have been writing television for a million years had a bunch of ideas, and they were like, this is how you make a movie, right? And unfortunately, it doesn't all kind of congeal. And then when it's put in the hands of someone that can't handle those tonal shifts, where it's like, and then there's a bomb threat. There's so much going on that it never, but I want to also just say, because I'm kind of on your wavelength here, Ryan, on the, I love a messy movie. I love a movie that tries to do like a bunch of shit and might not all work, but I just respect the attempts. And this movie does that in a lot of ways that I do find fascinating. And I imagine if I watched it at midnight, I probably would have been a lot more on board with it. But Kenny, you have something to say?
I got so much to say always. Her career is so interesting to me in that, like,
Cate Blanchett's.
That's correct. Yeah. She gets the Oscar nomination for, you know, what was obviously like a tour de force performance. And, you know, a big, loud Oscar nominated movie playing a, you know, massive historical figure, one of the few historical figures available to female actors.
And led to like a pretty like down to the wire Oscar campaign, if I remember correctly, between her and Gwyneth Paltrow. And I think a lot of people thought she had a really good shot of winning, having basically come out of nowhere. But
I guess. But, you know, I think it's interesting that she then goes in 99. So she's an Australian actor. She basically hadn't been in an American film before that. Australian TV actor. In 99, she's in two movies. We already did one of them, Talent of Mr. Ripley, and
fucking love
this film. She took the fourth lead in two films, right? Mm-hmm. In two American films with three. Now, Angelina Jolie was not a big actor at this time, but big actors in these films. And playing Americans in both films.
Yep.
Which I think is really interesting. And I think it's really interesting that she's playing in this particular film a low class or lower class housewife living in the world's ugliest development. I don't know if you've noticed.
Horrible.
It was like a hideous home. And it just was just a horrible place for a person to grow up and for a person to live.
Joyless life.
So she already has my sympathies. Terrible.
Yeah.
What was the movie we just did that were? Oh, it was like in She Devil. It's like living in She Devil.
Correct.
Even She Devil. She has a little bit. She Devil had more charm.
Can I? And maybe this is completely off base, but she's got a little bit of Carmela Soprano in her. There's a little bit of something there that I sensed.
It's not off base. I think that I think the scene Ryan alluded to earlier of all the women shitting on their husbands is straight out of The Sopranos or straight out of, you know, a Donnie Brasco or whatever it is. But I think it's interesting that she decided to go basically start from the bottom, you know, in American studio films. And then she gets, you know, Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring. And then she really, you know, takes off. Mm-hmm. But and then she's in literally every fucking movie from here on out. It's wild how many films she was in. But I think that's interesting.
I think it's also, I agree with what you're saying, Kenny, and I think also, you know, I remember we talked about this on the Talented Mr. Ripley episode, but, you know, that's a movie that is being shot before, you know, Shakespeare in Love and Elizabeth and all these things are happening, right? So, like, you've got Anthony Minghella's follow-up to The English Patient starring, you know, Matt Damon and Gwyneth Paltrow and Cate Blanchett. It's understandable, I think, to want to be on that train.
She was in An Ideal Husband, too. I totally forgot that.
Right, we talked about that, too. But, yeah, it's just, she is a fascinating actor. And, again, as I watched this film, I was just like, I really honestly think that she could do anything. Like, you could basically put her in any movie and she's going to succeed. She's in bad movies from time to time, but she's never bad as far as I'm concerned, even when perhaps the material isn't up to par. I want to kind of walk through the plot of this a little bit. We've hit a bunch of this stuff, but there's some stuff I want to kind of hit on. We're immediately kind of thrown into this, into a air traffic controller scenario. I really love the camaraderie, the workplace environment. I think it's really fascinating. It's one of my favorite things about this movie. It's why this movie is not a complete wash for me, is the universe that it takes place in, which I've never seen before, and I certainly haven't seen since. No one has returned to this sandbox. I like the shots. I like all the stuff that they do within the actual computer screens themselves when you're either looking through it or inside his head and seeing all the, like, again, weird, like tonally strange, like feels like something out of a Tony Scott movie, but you're also just like, cool. But I'm just
Tony Scott would have made a great director of Pushing 10.
Tony Scott's version of Pushing 10 would have been better. With this cast.
Absolutely.
I don't know if it would have been amazing. It would have been competent. It would have been. Who is the best guy? Who's or
that's
lady?
A really good question.
Who's the best person
on the crew? Like in this crew?
No. Like, who's the best director to take it? Who should have directed
you,
this movie?
Yes, and it doesn't have to be someone who was, you know, alive and kicking in 99. But who's the first?
That's a really good question. I was thinking about that actually earlier today, because like here's what's so funny, because you said this, Kenny, about like the 79 version, the 89 version, the 2009 version, which is just to say it says something about this script that it feels like it could have been directed by like a bunch of different people in a bunch of different ways, mm-hmm. and it might have been interesting, yeah. which says something. I don't know what it says, though. I don't know if that means it's a good script or if it means that it's just like a
weird
skeleton.
Well, you know, I have to say, I do think that who I said earlier, I said it off the top of my head, but I mean, like the Sydney Pollack, Alan Pakula, like they sure. could handle different weird mm-hmm. tones. I mean, even a Sidney Lumet, like kind of mm-hmm. this was his sort of bread and butter mm-hmm. for the 80s and 90s, sort of, you know, semi-comedy sort of, but like there's kind of pretty dramatic overtones. Like I can think that could have carried the weight that Kenny was talking about earlier, yeah. you know, in terms of actually getting into the psyches of these characters. I think it would take a kind of much better or a new Norman Jewison, you know, sort of that, I don't know. These were adult movies. Like it feels like they're trying to go for an adult tone here. Yeah. You know, there's a PTSD vibe
for
to
sure.
this. And, you know, it's interesting.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy ad free. That's amazon.com/comedy ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I think a lot of the people you named, Pakula, Pollack, Jewison, would have made better movies. Mm-hmm. I think Lumet would have been a great movie. You know, like that's like that. Because I'm already thinking about his version, and it would have, first of all, looked better. I don't care if this is where the air traffic controller place actually is. That's not where I would have placed it. You know, I would have placed it somewhere that actually is that actually is interesting and has some texture. It has some
right.
feel.
Give me
and has
LaGuardia,
some life to it.
And I, you know,
that's the first decision he would have made that would have like started to interest me. And then he wouldn't have had them live in like the miserable New Jersey or Long Island crap land they lived. They would have lived like somewhere that has character and all these little things just starting from, and the I mean, like, it's hard to believe that Mike Newell directed Donnie Brasco, because like that restaurant, like I've been watching a lot of Taxi, and that is like the shitty fucking restaurant they go to in Taxi.
Yep.
Like it's like they use the same set. Everything just would have had more character imbued into it from the beginning. And John Cusack, I don't think, would have been cast. You would have had cast someone more along the lines of like
John Hirsch would have been great.
Fucking awesome. Yeah. Like someone with some fucking pathos. And then I would have started to get the movie, but
there are two filmmakers that came to mind that are more in the vein of this. The best version of this film, as opposed to what I totally agree with you is mm-hmm. the best version of the 70s version of this. Curtis Hanson, I think, mm-hmm. could have made an interesting version of this. I think that he's navigated, like, I think that Wonder Boys is one of my favorite films, but navigates weird terrain and
terms
of comedy
a better
and drama.
Yeah, he would have made
a better. And I don't know how you're going to feel about this, Kenny, but I'm curious as to what Alexander Payne might have done with this.
Negatively.
Alexander Payne feels like someone who might have done something interesting with this material as well.
Would have made the worst movie, Phil. You know?
I assume that Kenny wouldn't be a fan of it, but I do think that it would just be, I think that he understands like sad sack guys that are sort of lost. And by the way, like I'm not suggesting that, that he's necessarily the right guy, but like he's more right than Mike Newell is.
Yeah. No, Mike Newell is definitely not right. We can all agree on that.
Mike Newell proved to be not right. He proved that he was not not equal to this material and not equal to making this kind of, you know, modern studio movie set in America. That's just clearly not something he's capable of doing. I wouldn't have necessarily thought that going into it. So I don't think it was like a bad decision. Alexander Payne would have made a movie that was nominated for 7 or 8 Oscars and two people would have won and he would have won. And the Charleses would have won best screenplay for the exact same fucking screenplay. And I would have 20 years later said, it's one of the 5 worst fucking films ever made. But that's what I get because you're right that this does fall into the Alexander Payne, but they would have I don't know if you know this, Ryan. I don't know if you've listened to our Alexander Payne and Alexander Payne adjacent episodes, but
I gathered Kenny and from the 10 minutes prior.
And even though I think Election is like one of the greatest movies ever made, but I think like everything else he's done is reprehensible, and this would have fallen into the reprehensible camp.
Brutal.
I don't understand Sideways. I fundamentally don't understand the movie, and this would have been all the Sideways.
This has
stuff.
A Descendants vibe. This would have been, you know,
too.
Yeah. This has a sideways vibe. Like, it does have that, you know?
He would have made them into two horn dogs who would have treated the women even worse until they did something unbelievably terrible to the men.
Correct.
One of them would have cut off a dick or something. And then and then they would have run down the street holding the dick. And then everyone would have been like, Alexander Payne! What a genius!
All right. So
I just described Sideways. That's what happens in Sideways. He's not holding a dick. His own dick is out. And people are like, oh!
Terrible
movie.
So Billy Bob Thornton shows up at the
airport. You think it's a terrible movie, right?
Yeah.
Holy fucking shit. Can we go on a date?
I hate that movie.
You really not like that movie?
It's terrible. I worked in a movie theater when it played. I worked at the Lemley Monica, and it was the worst crowd of movie theater like history. I couldn't. They were bringing wine and drinking out of the bottle. It was fucking disgusting.
But it also
mimicked sort of the tone of this weird bad movie. Like, it's an odd film.
Sure.
I've never heard a interesting, coherent, compelling argument for why this is good outside of like
Giamatti, exactly.
Paul Giamatti's speech about the grape is affecting. And I'm just like,
no,
this is not good writing.
It's a very bougie movie. Like,
I don't think you like it that much, Phil. Yeah. Right? You don't even like that.
I don't love it. I watched it relatively recently. I think I watched it around the time that we did Election because I was trying to kind of rewatch some of Alexander Payne's. And listen, I'm not an Alexander Payne fan. I don't hate him as much as Kenny does, and I just find his films to be sort of kind of neither here nor there for me. And you know,
I think Sideways is worse than Tootsie. That's how bad it is.
Is it worse than The Departed?
I love Tootsie. You like Tootsie. How can you not like Tootsie?
Oh, here we go. Now you guys aren't going to go on a date.
We'll talk about that another time. Is it worse than The Departed? That's a great question. So those are probably the three films that are held up as classics that I just think are dog shit. And I think that honestly, if I'm being like completely honest, you're not going to believe me, Phil.
You think Sideways is worse than Departed?
I think The Departed is the best of the three. And I which actually surprises me to say it, but like, I don't think The Departed, I think The Departed, my bit, Ryan, is how much I hate The Departed. So it's my, I guess you hate it
Not
too,
at
it
all.
Like. Or you don't. You love it. Oh, you love it. Okay. Okay, so So The Departed, I think, is the least offensive of the three. And I don't mean from like a woke 2020 point of view. I think from a storytelling point of view and also from treatment of female character point of view. But and the message of the movie, The Departed is just a stupid ass fucking popcorn flick that somehow won Best Picture. Sideways is absurd and infuriating, disgusting. And Tootsie's the most misogynistic movie ever made.
True, but grandly entertaining.
So to pivot back to
also grandly entertaining.
Briefly, A bunch of shit happens, as we've talked about, Billy Bob showing up, blah, blah, blah. We meet Angelina Jolie at a barbecue. Kenny mentioned how much he hates her wig in this movie at lunch today.
I do.
I think she looks great. She always looks great. Like,
I love her southern accent.
Yes. She brings, again, we've talked about this a little bit, but she brings this energy to it. There's a danger to Angelina Jolie. She feels dangerous. So like when she walks into that barbecue, even when like there's a moment when she's walking towards the bar and these two kids get in the way and she feigns this like cutesy face to the kids when she fucking
loaded, you know,
the kids clearly.
Right.
Yeah. It's a great moment.
I think you just made an interesting observation about Angelina Jolie in danger. Yeah. And I think that is the one thing that's held her back as a movie star, because it's been very hard for her to play. I'm going to put it differently. I think she feels a responsibility to play quote unquote strong women or quote unquote badass women. And she's so good at it. I think Salta is like a fucking A+. And I think she's like, you know, great and fucking Wanted. And I think she's just always, always great as these badasses. But in a movie like, you know, Changeling, where she has to play vulnerable, it does kind of feel weird. It feels like it feels more like a performance. And I think that's kind of the one thing that she can't really pull off. It's not even that she can't pull off. It's the one thing that like our preconceived notions of her as an actress put up a bit of a barrier for, I think, the audience accepting her in those roles.
Well, I think it's interesting, you know, she wins, as we've mentioned, she wins the Academy Award in 99 for
very dangerous performance.
She's very good in that movie, though. And she actually shows, I think, the range of, you know, there is a vulnerability to her in that movie. There is, like, she does all the things. She certainly checks all of the Academy Award boxes. But she's very, very good in that film. This is a movie that I don't even know when this movie was shot. But, like, she's only doing a couple days on this movie, is my guess. I mean, maybe 2 weeks of this shoot. I mean, at most.
And what a 2 weeks it was.
What a roller coaster. The reason I bring this up is her and Nick connect a little bit over the drinks at the barbecue, and then they bump into each other at a grocery store because she's crying because a plant of hers died. I don't know. They have this dinner scene, and I don't know what to make of their chemistry. It's not bad, but it's also like not good. Like I can't. Do you sort of know what I'm getting at? Like there is something between John Cusack and her, or Nick and Mary, that is interesting. But it's also kind of like, but is this sexual? I'm not really sure this is sexual. Like when they do end up in bed together, I'm just like, these two had sex? I'm just not sure.
It's a real icky moment. I mean, I definitely agree. But again, like I still see it as this sort of like Job-like thing that he goes through and doesn't really recover from in the end. And it starts with this moment, this big mistake. You know, I do think that, like, again, in more able hands, this arc is actually like a really fucking, like, you know, eyes wide shut, like journey. You know, I think that's sort of fascinating because Angelina Jolie kind of does it. She's fantastic at that. And it's a very kind of, again, poorly written, but very vulnerable performance in a very odd way. Like why she goes so far, you know, as an actor is interesting to me because, you know, and prior to this, she did Gia, which is a really fucking gnarly movie. And she's incredible in it. So you knew she had the capacity to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think she's looking for a fantastic role. And this isn't really it. However, her and Billy Bob are fantastic. Her and John Cusack have a very funny, I love the twist that like within a couple scenes, she's told Billy Bob, you know, that she had sex with John Cusack. Mm-hmm. And now that fucks him up even more. He's even more like kind of off his game than ever before, you know?
Yeah. The film makes choices that I did not see coming.
I'm confident that there's a better film here. I feel like Newell approached this like it was any other movie, and it just isn't. Like that's the arc you just described. That's so unusual, and like the thing that like the character move
of sleeping with your rival's wife when you're the beta and he's the alpha is not something I've seen. It's not something that most characters should be capable of, but he's only barely the beta in this relationship, right? Yeah. He's only like any, you know, in his dynamic with any other person in that room, he's the one who, you know, can steal their wife if he wants to. Mm-hmm. So I think that that was really kind of weird. I think Angelina Jolie telling Billy Bob Thornton was really kind of weird and interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think that this all could have played into this, like, John Cusack, am I losing my mind? Because everything that's happening is so fucking strange. Yes. You know, the strangest part of the movie is that Billy Bob Thornton is able to make those baskets with that form. Like, that is the biggest piece of magical realism in the entire film.
I also think the best
part was that he missed. I was actually joking, but now I'm serious.
That's what,
like, he missed.
He's
like,
so cool. And he's cool. Yeah. He's so cool and about it.
And he pays him. He's like, you either get it or you don't. You either sink it or you don't. There's a humor in this film as well that is not the type of humor necessarily that I would have associated with the Charles Brothers in terms of Cheers or Frasier, what have you. There's a so Nick sleeps with Mary, comes home.
Who's 19?
Yeah, yes. So he comes home.
Angelina Jolie's not, but the character is.
Right. Connie has been at a drawing class and shows a picture she drew of JFK, to which she says, I feel like I know him. And he says, we all do. Like, weird jokes in this movie, man. Like, weird things where just like there is, and I know that I often bring them up, but like, there is a Coen Brothers-y kind of vibe in this movie a little bit that could have been interesting. Like, that kind of
buried in there, but yeah
like that kind of losery central character that's just everything's kind of getting away from him, and he doesn't really like, there is that kind of vibe to it.
Can you see this?
That's Albert Einstein.
That's right. That's a picture of my mom drew of Albert Einstein.
This is something
This is something women do.
Okay. I then we have this whole like weirdness where Nick becomes paranoid that Billy Bob is going to fuck Kate Blanchett. So he's scared that like he's going to get revenge by having sex with Kate Blanchett. And then he goes to, which Kenny mentioned, the weightlifting muscle performance that Vicki Lewis is doing.
Which is so funny because you and I were talking about that. That's what I was telling you. You and I were, because Zack Snyder had just apparently pitched an idea to Darren Aronofsky about a female, quote unquote, female wrestler. Mm-hmm. Starring Amy Adams as a female bodybuilder, mm-hmm. which I think, you know, there's a movie there Adams, but as I said, with Julie Bowen. But it was so funny that like the next day we're watching this film about, of course, Vicki Lewis from fucking News Radio is a muscle person.
Yeah. I bought it.
Great. I'm in.
Yeah.
But good
so
for her.
So his friend Barry is there.
I love your mute boyfriend too.
He's there with his buddy Barry, who is played by Jake Weber, who's got a real James Spader vibe in this movie. Barry gives a really interesting speech about how like their jobs are about controlling chaos in the sky. Like, again, like there's all these really interesting thesis statements kicking around this movie that just don't speak to each other, but they're all kind of like saying interesting things. Connie's dad dies. They get on a plane to go to New York, and Connie tells Nick that she slept with Russell. Are we supposed to believe that she did that, though?
I don't know.
I'm asking that legitimately, Ryan. Like, I couldn't tell if I was supposed to know if, like, did you think that she slept with Russell?
Did she just say it?
No. I kind of felt like it was a mystery that kind of hung over the movie, like an intentional mystery that hangs over it. Because here's the thing, like there is that very clear scene of flirtation between the two of them, you know, and I think it's actually one of the best scenes in the movie where, you know, he's sort of, I don't know, interested in what John Cusack could give two shits about. And just that kind of look of like acceptance and seduction. There's a sexiness to the two of them in that scene, and it's a kind of cool little scene. I don't know, and I think that then, you know, it's sort of like with John Cusack's character. It, again, probably poorly executed, but I sort of get the feeling that the idea is that we don't really know if that actually happened, you know, that perhaps it did, perhaps it didn't, but it did. It clearly did.
But I think you're giving the movie more credit than it deserves. We should know that. That's a fact that we should know. It's not a thing that we should be like, huh, I don't know.
Yeah, that's a big swing of the movie. I will admit that.
Withholding that piece of information,
yes,
really does a disservice to the Cate Blanchett character.
I agree,
because then you don't understand what's going on at the end of the movie because you're focused on her. It's so weird. It's such a mistake. But
it's very strange.
Again, these are little things that you do when you rewrite a script and you're the director and you know. Maybe Barry shouldn't be 19, or maybe we should know definitively whether or not they slept together.
Valid criticisms, all.
Ryan,
it is.
I definitely do not hate this movie as much as I did when we started this podcast.
Okay,
so that's something.
I want to sort of just to kind of barrel through this a little bit, just because there is still some
huge moments
in the plot that we didn't really unpack. So that now we're at this a really interesting part of the film where they're flying back from New York, and John Cusack is convinced that Billy Bob is forcing their plane through an electrical storm to try to kill him, which, as I mentioned to Kenny today, I think is fucking great. Like, it's a great idea. It's a great thing, but it's also just like, what? Like, it's bonkers. It's a bonkers thing. Anyway,
in a good movie, that is like the climax of the film. And that's what completely destroys his life, thinking that happened. And then Billy Bob walks away with Cate and Angelina in a throuple. Like, that's what I would
say. Yes. But then the weird part is that this happens.
Being a great director like I am.
But this happens, and then he comes back to work, gets angry at Billy Bob. There's a bomb threat that forces everybody out of the air traffic control center.
Which happened like that. It's like those scenes happen so close together. I'm like, what? I'm like, how did he get here? I'm from New York. I know what the Van Wick is like, buddy. You're not getting there that fast. Van Wick and the Kennedy Expressway and fucking China. No, come on.
The guy who's running the air traffic control center very flippantly says there's a bomb threat. Like, just there is very little weight.
Well, it's the line that literally breaks up the fight that they're having. That's the insertion of the bomb threat. Is like,
guys,
you know, this, it's like the end of Gangs of New York. You know what I mean? It's sort of like, we've got bigger fish to fry. There's a bigger plot point we need to insert here. Yeah. Please stop fighting.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like Watchmen. There's an alien.
So basically there's a bomb threat. Everyone's forced out of the air traffic control center. And then there is a scene that I actually kind of loved, which is these two guys need to land like a bazillion planes in 26 minutes or something crazy like that. And they're doing it and also shit talking each other in between landing planes. Again, great scene. It's the type of thing that you're like, I could see the Charles Brothers being like, and then they're like, they're, you know, exchanging barbs while also being like, it's a cool thing.
Yeah.
But then, because I don't know if this is studio, I don't know, whatever, but then like they land all the planes, or it seems there's a plane they can't get in contact with. So Nick runs out of the building thinking that Russell's behind him.
And all of a sudden he's on the plane.
Yeah.
He kind of how he got there, but he's no so kidding.
Crazy. No, but he runs out of the building in slow motion.
No, okay. Yeah,
he in slow motion, Nick runs out of the building, thinking that Russell's behind him, but he's not. He later finds out that Russell was able to get in contact with someone that was able to talk mm-hmm. to the person on the plane mm-hmm. and land the plane or something. So Nick the airphone. Again has been
called an old woman's airphone.
Correct. You've like cuckolded Nick a second time, essentially, by like, or at least, you know, emasculated him by Russell, which he can't fucking deal with. Connie leaves him. He goes on this wanderlust to try to find Russell in Colorado, fly fishing or some shit like that. They have this weird scene where he tells him he needs to bathe his, cleanse his sins in the river.
This is. Okay, so again, this was so dumb. I mean, like, everything about this was so half-baked. Like, it's so half-baked. Like, this is like the drive to Colorado, the lack of understanding of time and space. Correct. Going to Colorado, like, there is and could have been something really interesting and fun going on there. Yeah. But at, you know, 2 hours into this movie,
yeah.
I mean, the fact that he found him fly fishing on the Colorado River on a tributary of the Colorado River.
It's insane.
It's a big country.
Yeah.
It's a big country, guys.
It's also just like, it feels so like, as Kenny said, it feels like a first pitch. It feels like, you know, the shitty pitch would be that he finds him fly fishing in the Colorado River.
It does work in, you know, in the context of this entire movie is a John Cusack fever dream, which like, you know, it's not, but like it could have been.
And like, I mean, Billy Ray's got this, Ryan? Like, I don't know. Again, like I'm mesmerized by even the outfit of him out there. He's kind of catching fish with his hands, and he's got like...
Billy Hillfish. Hand
and then he sends the fish out like he... It's a wonderful.
That's the best.
Remember
part
the line
of the movie.
Though? Do you remember the line where he says, "I caught him. He knows
it's
I caught
wonderful.
Him.
That's why I put it's him back. Just wonderful. That's a real magical Billy good. Ray. Billy
There's
Ray.
Also
Billy Bob.
A really great line earlier, where Nick says, "I spoke to Mary. She seems well. She had a message for you. See, I told you Colorado wasn't far enough."
That's a great okay, like a Frasier line. Like, you know what I mean? Like that's what I'm saying. There's a lot of great Cheers episodes. Like I feel like this is kind of like Cheers season 6, you know, with Kirstie Alley. There's a lot of that in here. And there's, you know, when you watch old Cheers and you watch old Frasier, 50% of those jokes really don't work. They don't work anymore. You know, it's just they're brilliant still, and they're a lot of fun to watch. But, you know, and I have to say about this movie, just in a weird way, like all of the airport stuff and all of the airplane stuff, none of it works anymore post 9/11. But in a weird way, that's another reason why I love like 99 movies and even, of course, further back. I love that back in the day, you can make a fun movie on a plane or a fun movie in like an airport. It's a very kind of time capsule type of thing. And the strangest like thing with this movie is you totally hit it earlier, Phil, about like, you know, sort of the toxic behavior of like, you know, Bill Clinton's politics hangs over this movie. But again, like it's so fascinating to see all of this, like he would have been, you know, like locked up by the FBI for life, like on Guantanamo Bay, if he had done those things in real life post 9/11. And, you know, the last shot is him having broken into the cockpit to take over comms to talk to his wife as the plane is flying over the Twin Towers is fucking like iconic to me.
when John Cusack is convinced that Billy Bob is trying to put the plane in an electrical storm, on two occasions he tries to bum rush the cockpit and is held back.
They have tasers now. They have weapons now. They didn't have them then.
I agree with you strongly, Ryan. I agree with you strongly. As I said, I've been watching Taxi from the beginning. And the first episode of Taxi, the climax takes place at the gate as Judd Hirsch's daughter is about to get on a plane. And all five of the goofs from the fucking Depot show up at the gate to witness this emotional moment. And yeah, of course I missed that. What kind of animal would it miss this stuff? That's what we really, that's
this is the end of an era. This pushing tin is one of the last great.
Yes. Yeah.
So to wrap this up real quick.
Decent.
Fine.
To wrap this up, basically, Nick won't cleanse himself in the river. And then Russell says, well, then there's only one other option. And so they go to a fucking runway. And
the local runway.
Right. Are thrown in the air by the jet wash of a 747 jet.
Scene is 20 seconds long. It happens so fast. Yeah. There's no lead up to it. Yeah. It's just like, I'm like, the climax of this movie just happened. And then they laugh, and then I think they like hold hands a little bit, and they're brothers for life.
There's
a little bit of the War of the Roses hold hand thing at the end. I think they go for, but
very really Top much. Gun.
But I'll say this: I do think it is
very Top Gun, strong Top Gun energy.
I'll say this: part of I think the reason that the scene is so short is because Mike Newell has no idea how to shoot it. Like, there's no coverage because it's all in front of a green screen. it's a nightmare vision of. Of like Jar Jar Binks CG of like them flying away in the jet wash. It's insane. And then basically we mentioned the end of the movie, which is that he reconciles with Connie by taking over the comms of a jet. And then he sings and it's bad. And then we see the Twin Towers as a plane flies by. It's a strange fucking thing. It's a strange movie. But I gotta say, I do have a strange affinity for it. I can't, and perhaps I haven't articulated it particularly well in this podcast. But I do think that there's a bunch of stuff here that I really enjoy, and it's possible that it's a different movie in my head that I'm enjoying than the one that we were given by Mike Newell. But yeah, I don't know. I want to rate this because I want us to do our top five Cate Blanchetts as well. In 99, saw this in the theater. I probably would have given it a 60. I didn't like it very much. Didn't hate it. It was kind of whatever it was. Seeing it through a little bit more of an analytical lens now, 20 years later, probably not as kind to it. I'm at a 51.
Wow.
Which is that, like, I wouldn't, again, I know that Kenny and I have differing opinions on the grading system.
We don't. I adhere to your grading system.
Which is that I might recommend this to a person for some scenes cast.
Yes. All right, we do have different feelings.
The 50% thing
on what recommendation means.
Yes. So I definitely kind of weirdly I'm going to stick it at 51. I'm certainly not going up. I don't think this movie deserves to be below 50. It's definitely on a razor's edge of oddity. But I kind of still like it. I obviously loved this conversation, and I think it kind of made me like it maybe a little bit more. It might be like a 52 now, but like, yeah. So
what were you before the podcast?
51.
Oh, you were 51 before the podcast.
I'll take it.
Yes.
Okay.
I feel like I did good work today.
All right.
Kenny's not going to be as kind, I don't think.
No, I am actually. I would be maybe even kinder.
Oh, wow.
I would say, all right, so the difference between me and Phil is Phil looks at recommendations as someone coming up to him and saying, should I watch Pushing Tin? Whereas I look at recommendations as people saying, what should I watch tonight?
Yeah.
And is there a situation where I would say, yeah, Pushington's the movie. Pushington, you should watch. So
in a vacuum, would Kenny pick Pushington?
In a vacuum, would I put Pushington on my master list of movies you should watch? I wouldn't be embarrassed recommending. I would be humiliated if I recommend.
This is not a sight and sound.
So I am. I was at a 31 before this podcast. I am at a 45 now. I think you did great work, Ryan. I think I don't think we spent this podcast mocking the film.
I agree.
As much, you know, so sometimes we have a great time sure. mocking films mm-hmm. and the number only goes down. But usually when we don't like a film, we usually mm-hmm. get real mad about it.
Correct.
And I really enjoyed this podcast because there's a lot here
yep.
to talk about, and you got to give the film credit for that. And I really am truly grappling with the, like, do I hold a film responsible for the film it could have been in my mind? Or do I give it credit for being the film it is and also giving birth to something that I, like, being the kind of thing that I think could have been improved upon? So, which I think is, like, a weirdly valuable Absolutely. Thing, right? You can't your imagination can't start to run wild if there is nothing, you know, to That's work true. With there. So yeah. there's plenty here. This is a good film for a podcast.
Well, and it's a quintessential 19. I mean, I love your podcast because, again, like, 1999 is such a it's such a formative year for me. Like, it really is a year that I consumed every movie that came out. It was a big.
We talked about that a lot before the podcast. It's a formative year for Ryan Marker, so we should do it.
Kind of consuming the year. Like, I love the good, the bad, and the ugly of 1999. And they are all great to me in their own weird way. And I love the way that you guys get into these things sort of beyond just sort of the movie. I mean, 1999 is a very big part of all of these movies. And I think it's a very big part of Pushington. Which is why I love it.
I agree. So what would your rating be back okay. in the day? Do you think? And then before podcast, after podcast.
Well, yeah. I would say that back in the day, I would have given it probably a 70, 72. And now okay. it's definitely okay. in the 80s. Like, I'd say it's still, I mean, it's an 80, 81 or 82. But we
have such insane guests sometimes. Just
I love you,
just
Ryan.
Just
I watched it the other night. I watched it the other night, myself. And I was just like, shocked. My God, this is such a joyous movie. I felt felt so happy watching it. And so
that's good.
That's great.
Well,
I'm so happy.
I know. It's a slight embarrassment, but ultimately, this is a movie I have definitely no. recommended to certain people who I think would appreciate something like this. It's not for everyone.
I think I speak for Kenny when I say that a movie bringing you joy is the best fucking thing, right? Like, I honestly know we're
it's
laughing.
Everything. It's everything.
It's everything. And I truly am thrilled that this movie brings you as much joy as it does. And on some yeah. level, I kind of understand
I
it.
Know you do. I know, but you guys both kind of like this. I just think, you know, you guys are doing all of them, and I definitely
did kind
of, you
know, like it.
That's a big thing to do, and there are greats that you have to. But, you know, I'm on Screen Drafts. Like, yes. I'm the co-host of Screen Drafts here. Where literally. Yes. Like, you can play a Pushington in a five on a certain type of genre list. It's
all right. So let's play the strain drafts game. First, I want to play the strain drafts game.
Okay, what are we? Okay.
Give me a potential screen drafts episode where one might play Pushington. It would not be vetoed by the commissioners. And you would say that's an approach where they sure. were played at five, like you just said, and where you'd be like, "That's a good one. That's a good one."
I mean, plane movies?
Definitely plane movies. I'd say movies? Even plane pre 9/11 movies. This is high. This is higher
have
than
you
five.
Done. Have you done?
We have not done plane. Wait,
have
movies,
you done plane?
And that's
movies?
Like a no brainer.
All right. So
yeah.
We're calling it.
We're calling plane movies right now. Just
it
so you
wouldn't,
know,
it wouldn't be near the list, Ryan. But oh, go ahead. Plane movies is a good one.
Would it be higher or lower than Flight Plan for you, Kenny?
Jody.
Flight Plan?
That's the Jodie Foster loses her kid on a big plane.
Definitely lower. That's a real. I mean, that's my favorite. My favorite sub genre is
right.
It's on a plane. So, okay,
fair enough.
Plane movies are very good. Yeah, it's a really because I feel like you can do a lot with the airport. There's a lot of airport movies.
Yeah, the airport.
Yeah.
I mean, airplane.
Totally. One of the greats.
I think airplane. I think I think airplane is probably the leader in the clubhouse.
Kenny, you are playing your hand now.
Yeah, you're playing your hand.
Oh,
right
I don't really expect Clay to let me on this podcast.
Yeah, I don't think Clay's going to let us do a plane.
I really threw my hat in the ring for dance movies, and I think I'm going to get it.
Oh, that's so great.
I'm Canadian. I'm getting the Canada draft only born in Canada.
Clay didn't know that I'm a dance writer, but I'm a dance writer. I write on... It's going to sound like a bit now because I've been doing bits all night. I write on the Step Up show. That is my job. I'm a dance man.
here's what I'm going to be, because speaking of screen drafts, we're going to do our top five Cate Blanchett movies, and I'm fascinated. I really want to know if Pushington cracks your five.
Oh yeah, because that's an interesting one. Let's do it by screen draft rules. The quality of the movie and not the quality of Cate's performance in the movie.
Correct.
Though I think, Phil, you know this better than most. There is some leeway in terms of like what makes a Cate Blanchett movie,
right?
You know what I mean.
And I there might be
the black there's swan one on here rule, that might, if you will.
Yeah. So we'll figure it out as we go along. But we're going to start at five. We're going to work our way up. We're going to round robin it. So I'll start at number five. My number five is The Aviator.
I don't believe
a very good movie that I what was that, Kenny?
I don't believe you. I don't believe that's really your five. Come on,
it is my five.
I believe him.
I really like that movie. I think that she's tremendous in it because, again,
she is.
I'm not incredible. A fan of what? What's up? What?
She's incredible in that movie.
Yeah, she's great.
I agree with that.
And the reason I do really like the film. It's my number five just because she's not in it that much. I am not generally speaking a fan of the mimicry performance, the performance of, it's just not really my thing. She transcends it somehow. She doesn't really look anything like Katharine Hepburn. And yet she's just, it's a phenomenal performance. She's amazing in it. What's your number five, Kenny?
Thor Ragnarok.
Nice.
I like that you got nice and close to the mic on that.
It's the only good Marvel movie made before. The only good non-Spider-Man Marvel movie, I think. And
she's great. She's fucking awesome.
She's so fucking good in it.
She's so
cool. And that great movie is so fucking awesome. Like, and she's so awesome in it. So that's my five.
I alluded to it earlier, Ryan? Phil. It's a movie called Pushington. Actually, I think that her performance in this actually is the best performance in the movie. And I think, again, it was my first. So I think it kind of holds a special place. And yeah, I think if you're looking for Cate Blanchett performances, I completely understand the premise of this. But I obviously have love for the full movie, but I particularly love Cate's performance. So that's my number five, Pushing 10.
I'm just thrilled that it's on the five, that it got the vote.
I think, I'm not pitching myself for this because I'm not the right person, but I think Cate Blanchett would be a particularly interesting screen draft.
I agree.
Because there is no... There are so many. I think I wouldn't be surprised if we each had different number ones. And when Phil and I do this, generally like two out of the three have the same number one and the other guy is the number... I wouldn't be surprised if my number one didn't make your lists. I wouldn't be surprised if my number two didn't... I wouldn't be surprised if my number two didn't make your lists.
I can see this. I totally can
see this. So, I don't think it's that far out of the mainstream. I just think that, you know, that she has
a varied career in a way that really is just fascinating.
15 movies that grown-ups... Yep. Responsible grown-ups could say are a top five movie for her.
100%.
Not including Pushington, but you know.
So my number four, also Thor Ragnarok. Great movie. She's great in it. I remember when the first stills came out with her as the villain. I was just like, well, fuck. I mean, this is just going to be, epic. So amazing. What's your four, Kenny?
My number four is Carol.
Interesting.
A tremendous, tremendous film and maybe her best performance except for my number one.
Ryan, what's your
one of my favorite things she's ever done is one of the shorts in the kind of anthology film by Jim Jarmusch, Coffee and Cigarettes. I don't know if you guys have ever seen it. It's sort of hard to find.
I have seen that, but I don't remember her.
She basically plays two she's sisters, twin sisters, and she plays both roles. And they're, you know, the whole movie, the premise of the movie is different scenes where they're just kind of in a diner, you know, drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes. But there's a very fascinating chemistry she has with herself. They're complete opposite sisters, and they do this great, like, it's just a wonderful scene. Again, with herself, and it's a magnificent performance because, yeah, it's so good. Like that whole movie is really like one of his greats.
I should watch it again. I remember really liking it, but I don't remember her particular.
Oh, it's so good.
I'm sure it's great. My number three is The Talented Mr. Ripley. I know she's not in it that much, but. First of all, it's one of my favorite films of 99, but also Talented Miss Ripley does something incredibly well, which is that Jude Law and Cate Blanchett disappear from the film for large swaths, but they're felt, their presence is felt, their characters are felt in such a way that when they do come back, she just feels, I just think she's fucking great in it. And her performance is just what could have been a throwaway. She just elevates it to a whole new level. And so that is my number three. What's yours, Kenny?
I'm so interested to see you guys top two. My number three is The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. A movie I really, really love, even though it's not nearly, you know, one of my favorite Fincher movies. But it's such a powerful movie, such a great performance. I mean, kind of having to play like this straight person aging in regular years. It's just as hard and important a role as Brad Pitt's work in that. Mm-hmm. And it's gorgeous. It's just a gorgeous film.
You don't meet too many Benjamin Button fans these days.
Oh, you're about to meet one.
Wow.
I knew it was coming on Phil's list.
That's incredible.
Ben Butts is what we call him on this podcast.
That's how I'm known.
Yeah. Not you.
What's your number three?
This is a movie that I love the movie. It's probably it won't be spoken about too much in the future, unfortunately, because it's a great performance by her, but it's Blue Jasmine, Woody Allen's Blue Jasmine.
That's
my number three. Your number what was
that's
that?
My number three. Again,
three.
Like Pushington, the more that I've watched Blue Jasmine, again, I'm more drawn to the performance of this film than the overall Streetcar Named Desire vibe to it that Woody Allen just sort of, you know, he's obviously just remaking that movie in a modern context. But again, incredible, incredible performances. Like, and she is unbelievably like commanding in a very like, intimately and broken performance. It is hard to watch this
She's
film.
Incredible.
And if again, like I love watching an actor grapple with a great role. And I really do think this is a great role for her. She definitely imbues it with all of her energy and all of her passion. And I think it's the last great Woody Allen film. I'm certainly not going to delineate his entire career because of his sins, but I will say that there are great gems that run throughout that filmography, and this is one of them. I mean, Andrew Dice Clay is great too.
Will, I just want to make Will. I want to make sure you got all that so we can strike that entire thing.
Right from four to two with I really do agree with you, and I grappled with putting Blue Jasmine on this list. I think she's tremendous in the film. I think actually her and Sally Hawkins are both fantastic in that movie. And I also agree that I think it's the last truly great Woody Allen film. My number two is The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, chime in, you know, to basically agree with Kenny in terms of, I think it's a beautiful film. I actually think I like it more than Kenny does in the Fincher
listing. You definitely
like
it more than me, but I don't think he's ever made a bad
film. No, I guess we're in the same.
Yeah, I think they're all really.
I think it is. I think it's a movie.
You think he's made a bad film,
Fincher?
Ryan? Maybe, yeah, maybe Alien 3. I don't know.
Alien 3, you know, no, I don't think he's made a bad film. I don't think he can make a bad film. I'm really curious to watch Benjamin Button, though, again. Like, I have to say, I haven't seen it since it came out. I don't remember.
I think Benjamin Button, I remember... It comes out, and it was obviously big Oscar bait. It was a very expensive film. It was, you know, it was a co-production, obviously gets a bunch of Oscar nominations. And I think that a lot of people dinged it with the whole, like, it's just Forrest Gump again. Yeah. And there were just a lot of things structurally. It's much better than Forrest Gump. I think that you would very much enjoy it today. Kenny mentioned something, which is what I love about the film is that their two timelines are essentially, they meet up in the middle. I think that Kenny says it beautifully in terms of how Cate Blanchett ages so beautifully and gracefully throughout the film. You really do think that you're watching a person age 50 years or some or somewhat throughout the course
it's
of the just, film.
Yeah,
it's amazing. It's,
there are movies or there are narratives like this where you're with characters for a long period of time and see them age. And obviously this, you know, uses a little bit of narrative trickery to get there, but it's in Fitzgerald, it's Fitzgerald's original conception. Yeah. It's there for the taking, and I think Fitz just did such a gorgeous job with such a weird piece of IP. So
okay,
I'm weird source material.
What's your number two, Kenny?
A movie that I guess neither of you are going to have, but a movie I saw at the Telluride Film Festival and was totally fucking blown away. Actually, I think this is my second. Yeah. Second film by this director, who I can't remember his name, but I'm Not There, the Bob Dylan movie.
Wow.
Oh, the Todd Haynes movie. Yeah.
Second Todd Haynes movie. I guess I didn't realize I was such a Todd Haynes person, but I loved I'm Not There. I loved her performance in I'm Not There. I love Don't Look. Yeah. It's called Don't Look Back, right?
Don't Look Back, yeah.
Which she's basically aping that entire movie, but it's so fucking cool. She's so cool doing it. I think all the fucking vignettes in that movie are awesome. And yeah, I really do love it, and I don't think that I don't think it's
a very good movie.
Remembered, even though she was nominated.
Yeah, that's interesting. I really I'm going to be doing actually a Bob Dylan draft coming up. It's going to be one of my his 80th birthday. Bob Dylan's turning 80.
So wait, what's the Dylan?
Okay,
draft?
So it's going to be movies he either appeared in, movies that are about him, or documentaries. You know, concert documentaries, so that he's performed in.
Sure.
So
not movies that have.
No, because you can get into a lot of like weird movies on the score. That, you know, so it's sure, there's enough. There's literally like 15 or 16 titles. So it'll be super. We will be bringing up that movie, I'm sure.
So what's your number two?
Hannah. Right? Joe Wright's Hannah. I don't know. Yeah.
God,
I'm
so proud of you guys right now. I'm feeling
Hannah
so good
is
about what's
fucking incredible. One of my all-time favorite movies. It's so good.
Hannah's a crazy movie.
I've seen it a bunch of times just because every time I watch it, I'm like, man, I discover something new. There's so many great little performances, so many great, Saoirse Ronan is incredible in this. But Cate Blanchett is fucking devious as fuck. She's so good when she plays a villainess. And she's just incredible. I mean, she's terrifying as hell.
It's actually it's her best
mode. I agree.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Her other best mode is Notes on a Scandal, like hot mom person. Like when she's like, I don't think she plays hot nearly enough.
Hot mom person.
Like she plays right. like modern hot person.
Yes.
She's obviously always a beautiful person, but like I love it when she just plays hot. Yeah. And she almost never. I wish there was more of that.
Yeah, she's very sexy.
So my number one is Carol. I think she's magnificent in that film. I think it's an amazing film. I think that, you know, I think it's interesting that we just said she's great as a villain and she's great as a modern mom sort of. And I think she's both of those things in Carol. Like there's just so
it's not
much
really
going
modern,
on.
But
not modern, but
that's what I mean. But yeah.
Yeah. I think she's tremendous in the film. I rewatched the film recently and I was floored by it all over again. She's just absolutely magnificent in that film. The one other performance that I did want to highlight almost made it. The movie's not great, but I really enjoyed her in Ocean's 8. She's got some energy in that film that I'm just like, I want more of that. Like whatever movie Cate Blanchett's in, I wish that we all got that movie for right. the 2 hours that it existed. But yes, Carol's my number one. What's your number one, Kenny?
The right answer, Blue Jasmine. The right it's just answer. Like it's blue, like Blue Jasmine is so fucking good. It is such a good fucking movie. And it's maybe the only time I can remember actually sitting there. I'm sorry, Ryan, I was joking, obviously, with you. Because I knew it was going to be
Kenny.
My number one.
You're killing me.
But it's
me.
One of the only times. That's what I do, baby. It was one of the only times I remember sitting in a theater and thinking, particularly for, you know, Blue Jasmine is not Elizabeth. That just screams Oscar. Right.
Yeah.
So it's the first time I remember sitting in a theater and thinking this person has to win an Oscar for this role. It's so affecting. And it is a small movie. Like it's a small human sized film. I really felt for that character. It was very timely in the moment. You know, it's about the wife, like essentially the powerless wife of someone who's losing everything. I also think Aunt Julia's Clay is fantastic in that.
He is very good at that.
Not as good as he is in The Star is Born. He should have got nominated for that. But like, I just think the movie fucking sings. And of course, it's Woody Allen's last good movie. He's only made horrible films since then. But he just, you know, Woody Allen's a tough one, obviously. And like movies like Sweet and Lowdown, which we've already done, I'm very comfortable like pretending they don't exist. Like movies that are like movies I would have just kind of would have written for before. Mm-hmm. But, or a movie like Manhattan, which was my favorite Woody Allen movie for most of my life. And now I think like rightfully kind of have done that doesn't exist, but for your, like your Annie Halls, your Hannah and your sisters, even Crimes and Misdemeanors, which Phil and I are grappling with whether to do it on our 89 podcast, ones that aren't like explicitly about how disgusting he is.
Yes.
I think we can still play with that. And unfortunately there never really is going to be a Woody Allen reappraisal, but if there ever was, this should be in the top five. It's just one of his finest films. So,
and it is a towering performance from her. You know what I mean? It was one of those things where, and you guys might remember that Oscar campaign got a little dicey and she sort of had to kind of do a little bit of navigating through a minefield. Not siding with Woody Allen, just Woody Allen and everything that you know encumbered. But the performance was just so great that it somehow rose above all of that, which is a testament to her. What's your number one, Ryan?
My number one is a movie actually Clay Keller recommended to me years ago at the video store called Notes on a Scandal. We spoke of it earlier. It's incredible. It's good. Like he, again, movie pushed on me. I was like, dude, like keep that away. Like the title kind of bugged me, like Notes on a Scandal. It just didn't sound great. The cover was sort of like, I don't know.
No, I like that movie a lot. It was like Ragnarok was like my funny pick, but that was on my list before.
It's so great. I mean, like she holds her own. It is a true like battle of great actors just throwing. I love movies too about like strange circumstances where, you know, a person's life is just thrown completely off because of one weird little incident, and this movie kind of pits these two people against each other, and Judi Dench is fucking nails it. Like just the scene of her smoking a cigarette, like laying in the tub, you know, just like dreaming of her revenge on Kate Blanchett. It's disturbing as fuck.
Oh, I would watch that tonight.
Like, it's so tight, good. 90 minutes. Good. It's a great movie.
It's a great movie.
I'm so proud of you guys for not picking
this. Was a great list. Honestly, I think
Ryan, do you like Lord of the Rings?
I like Lord of the Rings, but I'm never going to call any of those things great performances, honestly. It's just not my thing, you know.
Well, great.
They're fun movies, and I've watched them a few times. You know, I'm a big Lord of the Rings fan. Yep, absolutely. But she's barely in them, you know, like it's not exactly.
That was my thing came, and I know I have two movies where she's a supporting character, but she's two scenes in Lord of the Rings, or at least in Fellowship. So next week, I'm very curious if you've seen the movie that we're covering next week, Ryan. We're covering The Minus Man next week.
What a flick. What a flick.
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen The Minus Man, Ryan?
Wild movie that movie is.
Oh, God. See, this is Ryan. This is why we love you. I was rolling the dice. I was like, okay, I think we're going to throw it a Minus Man. I don't know if Ryan's seen it. So Hampton Fancher's The Minus Man, with a stacked cast of Owen Wilson, Jeanine Garofalo, Brian Cox, Mercedes Rule, Dwight Yoakam, Dennis Haysbert, Sheryl Crow, just a movie that does not exist. Kenny is editing his own version, The Plus Man, because he believes there's a much better movie to be made.
I think The Minus Man, as long as I can get the raw footage. I think the Minus Man could be turned into The Plus Man and could be an excellent movie with one very small change. And it's actually not dissimilar to this movie. Yeah. The very small change all has to do with
okay
perspective.
Yeah.
And Owen Wilson's grasp of reality.
Yeah.
And when I stumble upon it, I'm very proud of when I do. I just don't have the skills. So Will, our producer, Will, you remember you did agree to cut this for me, right?
Will.
so Will and I will be working on this, you know.
Will's, hopefully the disembodied voice of Will. Yep. 10-4. copy. Yeah, it is a very strange film. I thought we had a great episode. We had Adam Karp on, writer producer, a good friend of mine, who was working, I believe, at the production company at the time that this movie was made. So he had some insight into why this movie was made.
Is this an artisan movie? I think it's an artisan. But, yeah.
It is an artisan movie. Oh yeah, it's artisan. It's a strange film. Great conversation. Can't wait to see Kenny's cut. Great. It's going to be great.
Yeah.
But yeah. So next week, what are your thoughts on The Minus Man, Ryan? Just
I always
asked you,
liked
did
it.
You like it.
I liked it a lot. I like Owen Wilson. I think he gives it a great performance.
Yeah.
Yeah, the movie's and I like Hampton Fancher. I think he's a fascinating writer. I think it's an odd movie, don't get me wrong, but like, I don't know.
I mean, his name's Hampton Fancher. It's hard
it's
not
his
to
only
like
thing, and it's Fancher, kind of in its own way, but of course, well, but you know, directing Blade like Runner, a film, I mean, it's kind of a well-directed film.
Yeah, it's.
And I Kenny did mention this on the episode. It needs to be said that Fancher was born to a Mexican Danish mother and an American father, a physician in East Los Angeles. At 15, he ran away to Spain to become a flamenco dancer and renamed himself
Amazing.
Mario Montejo.
Amazing.
Yeah. He's a great man.
He's a great man.
It was either recut it as The Plus Man or try to get the rights to like
do a
TV movie of The Plus Man. I got to do something with this. We keep dancing around what's going to be Phil and I's big project. What's going to be a piece of IP out of this? I think it's going to be the Minus Man turned into The Plus Man.
Ryan, thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for coming on and talking Pushing Tin. We hope that you'll come back. I'm going to send you the 1989 movies that we're covering because I think that there might be some in there that you might want to dig into. Another big year for you, but we'd love to have you back. And truly, like, you know, Kenny and I, huge, huge fans of everything you guys do on Screen Drafts. And Kenny and I can't wait to come back on and give you another masterclass.
I want to take both of you guys on at a different time. That'd be a...
Whatever you want, brother.
Whatever.
I can't wait to ambush you on at the Arrow.
Please,
on,
of course.
Lawrence of Arabia.
Please, I can't wait. One of the great things I like about Screen Justice is meeting all of these various people every week. And like when I finally see them live at the Arrow, it's going to be so surreal and so exciting. I'm really looking forward to it. free popcorn for you guys. We'll get you great seats.
Cool. Oh, thank you. Thank you,
Phil.
So
have you done Lawrence of Arabia for your AFI thing yet? Right?
We have done it. Oh, we didn't. I have never seen it in the theater.
That's the way to do it. It's like got the the intermission and the entr'acte.
Yeah, that's the one.
It's so great. All that the bells and whistles of old time cinema. You know, it's wonderful. Let's do it.
The movie.
It's all right, guys.
All right.
All right.
Yeah, thank you.
See you guys so much. See you guys.
Brian, Phil and I have only ever seen one movie together. And we've been very good friends for about 15 years. We've seen one movie together, and it was Crawl.
It was Crawl. There you go.
Let's make Lawrence number two.
One last thing. Please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Also, please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits. Thank you to Ernie and Will for producing our episodes, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our artwork and theme songs, and most of all, thank you all for listening. 1999, podcast like it. You want a podcast like it. 1999.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.